Part 2. From Observation to Imagination. Chapter 3. Stalking the Brain Attic. The Power of Observation. It was Sunday night, and time for my dad to whip out the evening's reading. Earlier in the week, we had finished The Count of Monte Cristo, after a harrowing journey that took several months to complete, and the bar was set high indeed. And there, far from the castles, fortresses, and treasures of France, I found myself face to face with a man who could look at a new acquaintance for the first time and proclaim with utter certainty, "You have been in Afghanistan, I perceive." And Watson's reply, "How on earth did you know that?" was exactly how I immediately felt. How in the world did he know that? The matter, it was clear to me, went beyond simple observation of detail. Or did it? When Watson wonders how Holmes could have possibly known about his wartime service, he posits that someone told the detective beforehand. It's simply impossible that someone could tell such a thing just from looking.
"Nothing of the sort," says Holmes.
"It is entirely possible." He continues,
"I knew you came from Afghanistan.
From long habit, the train of thoughts ran so swiftly through my mind that I arrived at the conclusion without being conscious of intermediate steps. There were such steps, however. The train of reasoning ran, 'Here is a gentleman of a medical type, but with the air of a military man. Clearly an army doctor, then. He has just come from the tropics, for his face is dark, and that is not the natural tint of his skin, for his wrists are fair. He has undergone hardship and sickness, as his haggard face says clearly. His left arm has been injured. He holds it in a stiff and unnatural manner. Where in the tropics could an English army doctor have seen much hardship and got his arm wounded? Clearly, in Afghanistan. The whole train of thought did not occupy a second. I then remarked that you came from Afghanistan, and you were astonished. Sure enough, the starting point seems to be observation, plain and simple. Holmes looks at Watson and gleans at once details of his physical appearance, his demeanor, his manner. And out of those, he forms a picture of the man as a whole, just as the real-life Joseph Bell had done in the presence of the astonished Arthur Conan Doyle. But that's not all. Observation with a capital O, the way Holmes uses the word when he gives his new companion a brief history of his life with a single glance, does entail more than, well, observation, the lowercase kind. It's not just about the passive process of letting objects enter into your visual field. It is about knowing what and how to observe and directing your attention accordingly. What details do you focus on? What details do you omit? And how do you take in and capture those details that you do choose to zoom in on? In other words, how do you maximize your brain attic's potential? You don't just throw any old detail up there, if you remember Holmes's early admonitions. You want to keep it as clean as possible. Everything we choose to notice has the potential to become a future furnishing of our attics. And what's more, its addition will mean a change in the attic's landscape that will affect, in turn, each future addition. So we have to choose wisely. Choosing wisely means being selective. It means not only looking, but looking properly, looking with real thought. It means looking with the full knowledge that what you note, and how you note it, will form the basis of any future deductions you might make. It's about seeing a full picture, noting the details that matter, and understanding how to contextualize those details within a broader framework of thought. Why does Holmes note the details he does in Watson's appearance? And why did his real-life counterpart, Bell, choose to observe what he did in the demeanor of his new patient?
"You see, gentlemen," the surgeon told his students, "the man was a respectful man, but did not remove his hat. They do not in the army, but he would have learned civilian ways had he been long discharged. He had an air of authority," he continued, "and is obviously Scottish. As to Barbados, his complaint is elephantiasis, which is West Indian and not British, and the Scottish regiments are at present in that particular land."
And how did he know which of the many details of the patient's physical appearance were important? That came from sheer practice over many days and years. Dr. Bell had seen so many patients, heard so many life stories,
made so many diagnoses that at some point it all became natural, just as it did for Holmes. A young, inexperienced Bell would have hardly been capable of the same perspicacity. Holmes's explanation is preceded by the two men's discussion of the article, The Book of Life, that Holmes had written for the morning paper, the same article I referred to earlier, which explains how the possibility of an Atlantic or a Niagara could emerge from a single drop of water. After that aqueous start, Holmes proceeds to expand the principle to human interaction. Before turning to those moral and mental aspects of the matter which present the greatest difficulties, let the inquirer begin by mastering more elementary problems. Let him, on meeting a fellow mortal, learn at a glance to distinguish the history of the man and the trade or profession to which he belongs. Puerile as such an exercise may seem, it sharpens the faculties of observation and teaches one where to look and what to look for. By a man's fingernails, by his coat sleeve, by his boots, by his trouser knees, by the callosities of his forefinger and thumb, by his expression, by his shirt cuffs, by each of these things a man's calling is plainly revealed. That all united should fail to enlighten the competent inquirer in any case is almost inconceivable. Let's consider again how Holmes approaches Watson's stint in Afghanistan. When he lists the elements that allowed him to pinpoint the location of Watts's sojourn, he mentions, in one example of many, a tan in London, something that is clearly not representative of that climate, and so must have been acquired elsewhere, as illustrating his having arrived from a tropical location. His face, however, is haggard. Clearly, then, not a vacation, but something that made him unwell. And his bearing? An unnatural stiffness in one arm, such a stiffness as could result from an injury. Tropics, sickness, injury. Take them together as pieces of a greater picture, and voila, Afghanistan. Each observation is taken in context and in tandem with the others, not just as a standalone piece, but as something that contributes to an integral whole. Holmes doesn't just observe. As he looks, he asks the right questions about those observations, the questions that will allow him to put it all together, to deduce that ocean from the water drop. He need not have known about Afghanistan per se to know that Watson came from a war. He may not have known what to call it then, but he could have well come up with something along the lines of, "You have just come from the war, I perceive." Not as impressive sounding, to be sure, but having the same intent. As for profession, the category doctor precedes military doctor, category before subcategory, never the other way around. And about that doctor, quite a prosaic guess at a man's profession for someone who spends his life dealing with the spectacular. But prosaic doesn't mean wrong. As you'll note if you read Holmes's other explanations, rarely do his guesses of professions jump, unless with good reason, into the esoteric, sticking instead to more common elements and ones that are firmly grounded in observation and fact, not based on overheard information or conjecture. A doctor is clearly a much more common profession than, say, a detective, and Holmes would never forget that. Each observation must be integrated into an existing knowledge base. In fact, were Holmes to meet himself, he would categorically not guess his own profession. After all, he is the self-acknowledged only consulting detective in the world. Base rates, or the frequency of something in a general population, matter when it comes to asking the right questions. For now, we have Watson, the doctor from Afghanistan. As the good doctor himself says, it's all quite simple once you see the elements that led to the conclusion. But how do we learn to get to that conclusion on our own? It all comes down to a single word. Attention. Paying attention is anything but elementary. When Holmes and Watson first meet, Holmes at once correctly deduces Watson's history. But what of Watson's impressions? First, we know he pays little attention to the hospital, where he is heading to meet Holmes for the first time, as he enters it. "It was familiar ground," he tells us, "and he needs no guiding." When he reaches the lab, there is Holmes himself. Watson's first impression is shock at his strength. Holmes grips his hand, "with a strength for which, Watson, should hardly have given him credit. His second is surprise at Holmes's interest in the chemical test that he demonstrates for the newcomers. His third, the first actual observation of Holmes physically, I noticed that his hand was all mottled over with similar pieces of plaster and discolored with strong acids. The first two are impressions, or pre-impressions, more than observations, much closer to the instinctive, pre-conscious judgment of Joe Stranger or Mary Morstan in the prior chapter. Why shouldn't Holmes be strong? It seems that Watson has jumped the gun by assuming him to be somehow akin to a medical student, and thus someone who is not associated with great physical feats. Why shouldn't Holmes be excited? Again, Watson has already imputed his own views of what does and does not qualify as interesting onto his new acquaintance. The third is an observation in line with Holmes's own remarks on Watson, the observations that lead him to his deduction of service in Afghanistan, except that Watson only makes it because Holmes draws his attention to it by putting a Band-Aid on his finger and remarking on that very fact. I have to be careful, he explains. I dabble with poisons a good deal. The only real observation, as it turns out, is one that Watson doesn't actually make until it is pointed out to him. Why the lack of awareness? The superficial and highly subjective assessment? Watson answers for us when he enumerates his flaws to Holmes. After all, shouldn't prospective flatmates know the worst about each other? I am extremely lazy, he says. In four words, the essence of the entire problem. As it happens, Watson is far from alone. That fault bedevils most of us, at least when it comes to paying attention. In 1540, Hans Leidenspelder, a copperplate engraver, finished work on an engraving that was meant to be part of a series of seven. A female reclining on one elbow on a pillar, her eyes closed, her head resting on her left hand. Peeking out over her right shoulder, a donkey. The engraving's title, Acedia. The series, The Seven Deadly Sins. Acedia means literally not caring, sloth. A laziness of the mind that the Oxford Dictionary defines as spiritual or mental sloth, apathy. It's what the Benedictines called the noonday demon, that spirit of lethargy that tempted many a devoted monk to hours of idleness, where there should have rightly been spiritual labor. And it's what today might pass for attention deficit disorder, easy distractibility, low blood sugar, or whatever label we choose to put on that nagging inability to focus on what we need to get done. Whether you think of it as a sin, a temptation, a lazy habit of mind, or a medical condition, the phenomenon begs the same question. Why is it so damn hard to pay attention? It's not necessarily our fault. As neurologist Marcus Reichle learned after decades of looking at the brain, our minds are wired to wander. Wandering is their default. Whenever our thoughts are suspended between specific, discrete, goal-directed activities, the brain reverts to a so-called baseline, resting state. But don't let the word fool you, because the brain isn't at rest at all. Instead, it experiences tonic activity in what's now known as the DMN, the default mode network, the posterior cingulate cortex, the adjacent precuneus, and the medial prefrontal cortex. This baseline activation suggests that the brain is constantly gathering information from both the external world and our internal states. And what's more, that it is monitoring that information for signs of something that is worth its attention. And while such a state of readiness could be useful from an evolutionary standpoint, allowing us to detect potential predators, to think abstractly and make future plans, it also signifies something else. Our minds are made to wander. That is their resting state. Anything more requires an act of conscious will. The modern emphasis on multitasking plays into our natural tendencies quite well, often in frustrating ways. Every new input, every new demand that we place on our attention is like a possible predator. Ooh, says the brain. Maybe I should pay attention to that instead. And then along comes something else. We can feed our mind wandering ad infinitum. The result? We pay attention to everything and nothing as a matter of course. While our minds might be made to wander, they are not made to switch activities at anything approaching the speed of modern demands. We were supposed to remain ever ready to engage, but not to engage with multiple things at once, or even in rapid succession. Notice once more how Watson pays attention, or not, as the case may be, when he first meets Holmes. It's not that he doesn't see anything. He notes, "Countless bottles, broad, low tables were scattered about, which bristled with retorts, test tubes, and little Bunsen lamps with their blue flickering flames." All that detail, but nothing that makes a difference to the task at hand, his choice of future flatmate. Attention is a limited resource. Paying attention to one thing necessarily comes at the expense of another. Letting your eyes get too taken in by all of the scientific equipment in the laboratory prevents you from noticing anything of significance about the man in that same room. We cannot allocate our attention to multiple things at once and expect it to function at the same level as it would were we to focus on just one activity. Two tasks cannot possibly be in the attentional foreground at the same time. One will inevitably end up being the focus, and the other, or others, more akin to irrelevant noise, something to be filtered out. Or worse still, none will have the focus, and all will be, albeit slightly clearer, noise, but degrees of noise all the same. Think of it this way. I'm going to present you with a series of sentences. For each sentence, I want you to do two things. One, tell me if it is plausible or not by writing a P for plausible or an N for not plausible by the sentence. And two, memorize the final word of the sentence. At the end of all of the sentences, you will need to state the words in order. You can take no more than 5 seconds per sentence, which includes reading the sentence, deciding if it's plausible or not, and memorizing the final word. You can set a timer that beeps at every 5-second interval, or find one online, or try to approximate as best you can. Looking back at a sentence you've already completed is cheating. Imagine that each sentence vanishes once you've read it. Ready? She was worried about being too hot, so she took her new shawl. She drove along the bumpy road with a view to the sea. When we add on to our house, we will build a wooden duck. The workers knew he was not happy when they saw his smile. The place is such a maze, it is hard to find the right hall. The little girl looked at her toys, then played with her doll. Now please write down the final word of each sentence in order. Again, do not try to cheat by referring back to the sentences. Done? You've just completed a sentence verification and span task. How did you do? Fairly well at first, I'm guessing, but it may not have been quite as simple as you'd thought it would be. The mandatory time limit can make it tricky, as can the need to not only read but understand each sentence so that you can verify it. Instead of focusing on the last word, you have to process the meaning of the sentence as a whole as well. The more sentences there are, the more complex they become, the trickier it is to tell if they are plausible or not, and the less time I give you per sentence, the less likely you are to be able to keep the words in mind, especially if you don't have enough time to rehearse. However many words you can manage to recall, I can tell you several things. First, if I were to have you look at each sentence on a computer screen, especially at those times when it was the most difficult for you, that is, when the sentences were more complex, or when you were nearing the end of a list, so that you were keeping more final words in mind at the same time, you would have very likely missed any other letters or images that may have flashed on the screen while you were counting. Your eyes would have looked directly at them, and yet your brain would have been so preoccupied with reading, processing, and memorizing in a steady pattern that you would have failed to grasp them entirely. And your brain would have been right to ignore them. It would have distracted you too much to take active note, especially when you were in the middle of your given task. Consider the policeman in A Study in Scarlet who misses the criminal because he's too busy looking at the activity in the house. When Holmes asks him whether the street was empty, Rance, the policeman in question, says, "Well, it was, as far as anybody that could be of any good goes." And yet the criminal was right in front of his eyes. Only he didn't know how to look. Instead of a suspect, he saw a drunk man and failed to notice any incongruities or coincidences that might have told him otherwise. So busy was he trying to focus on his real job of looking at the crime scene. The phenomenon is often termed attentional blindness, a process whereby a focus on one element in a scene causes other elements to disappear. I myself like to call it attentive inattention. The concept was pioneered by Ulrich Neisser, the father of cognitive psychology. Neisser noticed how he could look out a window at twilight and either see the external world or focus on the reflection of the room in the glass. But he couldn't actively pay attention to both. Twilight or reflection had to give. He termed the concept selective looking. Later, in the laboratory, he observed that individuals who watched two superimposed videos in which people engaged in distinct activities, for instance, in one video they were playing cards and in the other basketball, could easily follow the action in either of the films, but would miss entirely any surprising event that happened in the other. If, for example, they were watching the basketball game, they would not notice if the card player suddenly stopped playing cards and instead stood up to shake hands. It was just like selective listening, a phenomenon discovered in the 1950s, in which people listening to a conversation with one ear would miss entirely something that was said in their other ear, except on an apparently much broader scale, since it now applied to multiple senses, not just to a single one. And ever since that initial discovery, it has been demonstrated over and over with visuals as egregious as people in gorilla suits, clowns on unicycles, and even, in a real-life case, a dead deer in the road escaping altogether the notice of people who were staring directly at them. Scary, isn't it? It should be. We are capable of wiping out entire chunks of our visual field without knowingly doing so. Holmes admonished Watson for seeing, but not observing. He could have gone a step further. Sometimes we don't even see. We don't even need to be actively engaged in a cognitively demanding task to let the world pass us by without so much as a realization of what we're missing. For instance, when we are in a foul mood, we quite literally see less than when we are happy. Our visual cortex actually takes in less information from the outside world. We could look at the exact same scene twice, once on a day that has been going well, and once on a day that hasn't, and we would notice less, and our brains would take in less on the gloomy day. We can't actually be aware unless we pay attention. No exceptions. Yes, awareness may require only minimal attention, but it does require some attention. Nothing happens quite automatically. We can't be aware of something if we don't attend to it. Let's go back to the sentence verification task for a moment. Not only will you have missed the proverbial twilight for focusing too intently at the reflection in the window, but the harder you were thinking, the more dilated your pupils will have become. I could probably tell your mental effort, as well as your memory load, your ease with the task, your rate of calculation, and even the neural activity of your locus coeruleus, the only source in the brain of the neurotransmitter norepinephrine and an area implicated in memory retrieval, a variety of anxiety syndromes, and selective attentional processing, which will also tell me whether you are likely to keep going or to give up, just by looking at the size of your pupils. But there is one encouraging thing, the importance and effectiveness of training, of brute practice, is overwhelmingly clear. If you were to do the sentence verification regularly, as some subjects did in fact do, your pupils would gradually get smaller, your recall would get more natural, and, miracle of all miracles, you'd notice those same letters or images or whatnot that you'd missed before. You'd probably even ask yourself, how in the world did I not see this earlier? What was previously taxing will have become more natural, more habitual, more effortless. In other words, easier. What used to be the purview of the Holmes system would have sneaked into the Watson system. And all it will have taken is a little bit of practice, a small dose of habit formation. Your brain can be one quick study if it wants to be. The trick is to duplicate that same process, to let your brain study and learn and make effortless what was once effortful, In something that lacks the discrete nature of a cognitive task like the sentence verification. In something that is so basic that we do it constantly without giving it much thought or attention. The task of looking and thinking. Daniel Kahneman argues repeatedly that System 1, our Watson system, is hard to train. It likes what it likes, it trusts what it trusts, and that's that. His solution? Make System 2, Holmes, do the work by taking System 1 forcibly out of the equation. For instance, use a checklist of characteristics when hiring a candidate for a job instead of relying on your impression. An impression that, as you'll recall, is formed within the first 5 minutes or less of meeting someone. Write a checklist of steps to follow in making a diagnosis of a problem, be it a sick patient, a broken car, writer's block, or whatever it is you face in your daily life, instead of trying to do it by so-called instinct. Checklists, formulas, structured procedures, those are your best bet, at least according to Kahneman. The home solution? Habit, habit, habit. That, and motivation. Become an expert of sorts at those types of decisions or observation that you want to excel at making. Reading people's professions, following their trains of thought, inferring their emotions, and thinking from their demeanor. Fine. But just as fine are things that go beyond the detective's purview, like learning to tell the quality of food from a glance, or the proper chess move from a board, or your opponent's intention in baseball, poker, or a business meeting from a gesture. If you learn first how to be selective accurately in order to accomplish precisely what it is you want to accomplish, you will be able to limit the damage that System Watson can do by preemptively teaching it not to muck it up. The important thing is the proper selective training, the presence of mind, coupled with the desire and the motivation to master your thought process. No one says it's easy. When it comes right down to it, there is no such thing as free attention. It all has to come from somewhere. And every time we place an additional demand on our attentional resources, be it by listening to music while walking, checking our email while working, or following 5 media streams at once, we limit the awareness that surrounds any one aspect and our ability to deal with it in an engaged, mindful, and productive manner. What's more, we wear ourselves out. Not only is attention limited, but it is a finite resource. We can drain it down only so much before it needs a reboot. Psychologist Roy Baumeister uses the analogy of a muscle to talk about self-control, an analogy that is just as appropriate when it comes to attention. Just as a muscle, our capacity for self-control has only so many exertions in it and will get tired with too much use. You need to replenish a muscle, actually physically replenish it, with glucose and a rest period. Baumeister is not talking about metaphorical energy, though a psych-you-up speech never hurt, to remain in peak form. Otherwise, performance will flag. Yes, the muscle will get bigger with use. You'll improve your self-control or attentional ability and be able to exercise it for longer and longer periods and at more complicated tasks. But its growth, too, is limited. Unless you take steroids, the exercise equivalent of a Ritalin or Adderall for superhuman attention, you will reach your limit. And even steroids take you only so far. And failure to use it? It will shrink right back to its pre-exercise size. Improving our natural attentional abilities. Picture this. Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson are visiting New York. Not so far-fetched. Their creator spends some memorable time in the city and decide to go to the top of the Empire State Building. When they arrive at the observation deck, they are accosted by a quirky stranger who proposes a contest. Which of them will be the first to spot an airplane in flight? They can use any of the viewing machines. In fact, the stranger even gives them each a stack of quarters and look wherever they'd like. The only consideration is who sees the plane first. How do the two go about the task? It may seem like an easy thing to do. An airplane is a pretty large bird, and the Empire State Building is a pretty tall house with a pretty commanding 360-degree view. But if you want to be first, it's not as simple as standing still and looking up or over. What if the plane is somewhere else? What if you can't see it from where you're standing? What if it's behind you? What if you could have been the first to spot one that was farther away if only you'd used your quarters on a viewing machine instead of standing there like an idiot with only your naked eyes? There are a lot of what-ifs. If you want to emerge victorious, that is. But they can be made manageable what-ifs if you view them as nothing more than a few strategy choices. Let's first imagine how Watson would go about the task. Watson, as we know, is energetic. He is quick to act and quick to move. And he's also quite competitive with Holmes. More than once, he tries to show that he, too, can play the detective game. There's nothing he likes more than thinking he can beat Holmes on his own turf. I'm willing to bet that he'll do something like the following. He won't waste a single moment in thought. Time's a-ticking, better move quickly. He'll try to cover as much ground as possible. It could come from anywhere, and I don't want to be the idiot who's left behind, that's for sure. And will thus likely plop coins into as many machines as he can find, and then run between them, scanning the horizon in between sprints. He may even experience a few false alarms. It's a plane! Oh no, it's a bird! In his desire to spot something. And when he does, he'll genuinely think that he's seeing a plane. And in between the running and the false spotting, he'll quickly run out of breath. This is horrid, he'll think. I'm exhausted. And anyway, what's the point? It's a stupid airplane. Let's hope for his sake that a real plane comes quickly. What of Holmes? I propose that he'd first orient himself, doing some quick calculation on the location of the airports, and thus the most likely direction of a plane. He would even, perhaps, factor in such elements as the relative likelihood of seeing a plane that's taking off or landing, given the time of day and the likeliest approach or takeoff paths, depending on the answer to the former consideration. He would then position himself so as to focus in on the area of greatest probability, perhaps throwing a coin in a machine for good measure and giving it a quick once-over to make sure he isn't missing anything. He would know when a bird was just a bird, or a passing shadow just a low-hanging cloud. He wouldn't rush. He would look, and he would listen, to see if a telltale noise might help direct his attention to a looming jet. He might even smell and feel the air for a changing wind or a whiff of gasoline. All the while, he'd be rubbing together his famous long-fingered hands, thinking, "Soon, it will come soon, and I know precisely where it will appear." Who would win? There's an element of chance involved, of course, and either man could get lucky. But play the game enough times, and I'd be willing to bet that Holmes would come out on top. While his strategy may at first glance seem slower, not nearly as decisive, and certainly not as inclusive as Watson's, at the end it would prove to be the superior of the two. Our brains aren't stupid. Just as we remain remarkably efficient and effective for a remarkable percentage of the time, despite our cognitive biases, so too our Watsonian attentional abilities are as they are for a reason. We don't notice everything because noticing everything, each sound, each smell, each sight, each touch, would make us crazy. In fact, a lack of filtering ability is the hallmark of many psychiatric conditions. And Watson had a point back there. Searching for that airplane? Perhaps not the best use of his time. You see, the problem isn't a lack of attention so much as a lack of mindfulness and direction. In the usual course of things, our brains pick and choose where to focus without much conscious forethought on our part. What we need to learn instead is how to tell our brains what and how to filter, instead of letting them be lazy and decide for us, based on what they think would make for the path of least resistance. Standing on top of the Empire State Building, watching quietly for airplanes, Sherlock Holmes has illustrated the four elements most likely to allow us to do just that: selectivity, objectivity, inclusivity, and engagement. 1. Be selective. Picture the following scene. A man passes by a bakery on his way to the office. The sweet smell of cinnamon follows him down the street. He pauses. He hesitates. He looks in the window. The beautiful glaze, the warm, buttery rolls, the rosy doughnuts kissed with a touch of sugar. He goes in. He asks for a cinnamon roll. "I'll go on my diet tomorrow," he says. "You only live once, And besides, today is an exception. It's brutally cold, and I have a tough meeting in just an hour. Now rewind and replay. A man passes by a bakery on his way to the office. He smells cinnamon. "I don't care much for cinnamon, now that I think about it," he says. "I far prefer nutmeg, and there isn't any here that I can smell." He pauses. He hesitates. He looks in the window. The oily, sugary glaze that has likely caused more heart attacks and blocked arteries than you can count. The dripping rolls drenched in butter. Actually, it's probably margarine, and everyone knows you can't make good rolls with that. The burned donuts that will sit like lumps in your stomach and make you wonder why you ever ate them to begin with. "Just as I thought," he says. "Nothing for me here." He walks on, hurrying to his morning meeting. "Maybe I'll have time to get coffee before," he thinks. What has changed between Scenario 1 and Scenario 2? Nothing visible. The sensory information has remained identical. But somehow, our hypothetical man's mindset has shifted, and that shift has, quite literally, affected how he experiences reality. It has changed how he is processing information, what he is paying attention to, and how his surroundings interact with his mind. It's entirely possible. Our vision is highly selective as is. The retina normally captures about 10 billion bits per second of visual information, but only 10,000 bits actually make it to the first layer of the visual cortex. And, to top it off, only 10% of the area synapses is dedicated to incoming visual information at all. Or, to put it differently, our brains are bombarded by something like 11 million pieces of data. That is, items in our surroundings that come at all of our senses, at once. Of that, we are able to consciously process only about 40. What that basically means is that we see precious little of what's around us, and what we think of as objective seeing would better be termed selective filtering. And our state of mind, our mood, our thoughts at any given moment, our motivation, and our goals can make it even more picky than it normally is. It's the essence of the cocktail party effect when we note our name out of the din in a room. Or of our tendency to notice the very things we are thinking about or have just learned at any given moment. Pregnant women noticing other pregnant women everywhere. People noting the dreams that then seem to come true and forgetting all of the others. Seeing the number 11 everywhere after 9/11. Nothing in the environment actually changes. There aren't suddenly more pregnant women or prescient dreams or instances of a particular number. Only your state does. That's why we are so prone to the feeling of coincidence. We forget all those times we were wrong or nothing happened, and remember only the moments that matched, because those are the ones we paid attention to in the first place. As one Wall Street guru cynically observed, the key to being seen as a visionary is to always make your predictions in opposing pairs. People will remember those that came true and promptly forget those that didn't. Our minds are set the way they are for a reason. It's exhausting to have the home system running on full all the time, and not very productive at that. There's a reason we're prone to filter out so much of our environment. To the brain, it's noise. If we tried to take it all in, we wouldn't last very long. Remember what Holmes said about your brain attic? It's precious real estate. Tread carefully and use it wisely. In other words, be selective about your attention. At first glance, this may seem counterintuitive. After all, aren't we trying to pay attention to more, not less? Yes, but the crucial distinction is between quantity and quality. We want to learn to pay attention better, to become superior observers. But we can't hope to achieve this if we thoughtlessly pay attention to everything. That's self-defeating. What we need to do is allocate our attention mindfully, and mindset is the beginning of that selectivity. Holmes knows this better than anyone. True, he can note in an instant the details of Watson's attire and demeanor, the furnishings of a room down to the most minute element. But he is just as likely to not notice the weather outside or the fact that Watson has had time to leave the apartment and return to it. It is not uncommon for Watson to point out that a storm is raging outside, only to have Holmes look up and say that he hadn't noticed. And in Sherlock, you will often find Holmes speaking to a blank wall long after Watson has retired or left the apartment altogether. Whatever the situation, answering the question of what, specifically, you want to accomplish will put you well on your way to knowing how to maximize your limited attentional resources. It will help direct your mind, prime it, so to speak, with the goals and thoughts that are actually important, and help put those that aren't into the background. Does your brain notice the sweet smell or the grease on the napkin? Does it focus on Watson's tan or the weather outside? Holmes doesn't theorize before he has the data, it's true, but he does form a precise plan of attack. He defines his objectives and the necessary elements for achieving them. So in The Hound of the Baskervilles, when Dr. Mortimer enters the sitting room, Holmes already knows what he wants to gain from the situation. His last words to Watson before the gentleman's entrance are, "What does Dr. James Mortimer, the man of science, ask of Sherlock Holmes, the specialist in crime?"